Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this week we have a bumper crop of stories to tell you about. First of all, we're going to be talking about big tech, big government and IT contracts. They don't normally go well together, but on a couple of very unusual occasions recently, they have been. We'll be finding out why. After that, the story of the sailors who have been trapped offshore due to the coronavirus crisis. There are thousands of sailors whose contracts have been extended, who are stuck in limbo, unable to go and see their families, in some cases not even being paid for their time. We'll be speaking about what can be done to try and get them home. And finally, a trip to the Street of Shame, where the Barclay brothers, the reclusive billionaire twins who own the Telegraph, the Ritz, and a great deal else besides, have fallen into an extraordinarily acrimonious row. There have been allegations of bugging, skullduggery, numerous other nefarious activities, and we'll be finding out what's going on there. But first, a walk along Whitehall. Richard Brooks is one of the Eye's correspondents on matters of big government, and in a recent issue of the magazine, he had a story about something, very unusually, going quite well. This was the furlough scheme designed to pay various workers who had been temporarily semi-laid off by their firms, and despite the various omissions that might have occurred with it, nonetheless, it has actually kind of worked. Richard wrote about this for The Eye, and I asked him a bit more about it. First of all, I asked him if it wasn't a bit unprofessional and contrary to the spirit of Private Eye to write about anything actually working.
I've almost had to apologise for the editor about that. There are two quite good news stories in one issue. It's normally sort of one for every 2 years of issues or something.
So the first one is about IT.
That's right. A few weeks ago, you might remember, when we all went into lockdown, one of the first announcements on the 23rd of March was that there would be a big furlough scheme under which millions of employees would carry on being paid by the government in order to keep their jobs. This presented a big challenge for the government because suddenly it's got to find out how much everybody's being paid by their employers and pay the right amount very quickly. It's not easy. They've tried to do similar things in the past and ended up with complete fiascos. And in fact, one magazine, that'd be Private Eye, expressed some scepticism about, you know, how successful this would be. But several weeks on, it turns out that it's been very successful. Actually, people have been paid on time. They've been paid the right amount. You know, it's kind of eased the burden of lockdown for millions of people.
And this, as you say, is a huge IT project, which makes it kind of doubly surprising, just because there have been so many. I mean, we've talked in the past on this podcast about, you know, the NHS IT system, which was a really costly and really cumbersome kind of mess at the end of it. So are there things that the government did right on this occasion that were different to previous occasions?
The difference with this one was that it wasn't outsourced to a big IT company. In fact, when you look at the history of HMRC and its IT, it's partly because of those big screw-ups in the past that it wasn't outsourced. There was a massive cock-up with the introduction of tax credits almost a couple of decades ago. They then had a series of IT reforms using a consortium called Aspire that went badly wrong and cost billions more than it should have done. And as a result of that, they started doing a lot of their own IT in-house. And by the time the coronavirus came around, they did have hundreds of IT specialists working on all the, you know, the various IT programs that HMRC needs. It's heavily dependent on good IT, as everybody knows. So those people were able to act pretty quickly. They understood the organization's setup very well. And, you know, they could quickly put in place a new system, which they couldn't have done if there'd been a big American IT company who'd been called up on the 23rd of March and who would have said, well, that's going to cost you.
So that's good news story number one. Then we turn on a few pages in the magazine and we find good news story number two, which is about the testing. I mean, this is kind of even more worrying. Well, this is a mixed one. There's a bit of bad news in it.
It's the part of the story that isn't quite as bad as the rest of the story. And the bit that isn't quite so bad is the testing being conducted by local public health officials who are identifying most of the contacts of people who've tested positive for COVID. You know, around about, we're talking around about the 90% mark. And at the same time, there are far fewer of those people than there are in the part of the program that has been outsourced to Deloitte and Serco. The outsourced bit is far bigger,
yeah,
but it's only identifying around 12% of the contacts of people who've tested positive.
Whereas the other 88% are being identified by the local authorities who are in charge of this.
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which makes, if you do the maths, it makes a local public health official 50 times more effective than the call centre being run by Serco.
Okay, so that needs a bit more attention because that feels so surprising and remarkable. I mean, the numbers, yeah, the ratio is just so high. So what's going on there?
Well, I think there are probably two parts to that. One is that public health officials are better at a public health job like tracing contacts of people who've got a disease. That's partly what they do. And I think it also reflects the fact that this job should be done at a local level. That's where you're going to find people. That's how you do locate those contacts who need to isolate. You don't do it by setting up a big centralised operation staffed by 20,000 or so people with no experience in the job and asking them to get on the phone with a script.
These people, all of these people, so you've got 21,000 outsourced workers and, yeah, as you've said, about 3,000 government-employed public health officials who are doing similar jobs, basically.
Yeah.
They are contacting the contacts, as it were, of people who have tested positive.
Yeah.
The magazine has been covering the nightmare of being one of the outsourced contact tracers because we've had Contact Tracy,
yeah,
writing about, yeah, about, yes, her experiences. Again, this feels like another slight victory for public health officials over...
Yes, exactly, but it's not Tracy's fault, of course. It's the job she's been given, she and thousands of other people like her. And the jobs they haven't been given, many of them are sitting there by the phone or were for a while waiting for their first instructions. They weren't on the ground, you know. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but local officials have people on the ground. They know their areas. They know where people might have met. They know where they might have gone. They know what questions to ask people in their areas in order to establish contacts. And experts in this field, epidemiologists and other public health specialists, know this. And, you know, the more sensible ones have been advising the government that this is what they should have done from the outset. But they didn't.
So one of the other aspects of the whole coronavirus story that's been in the news is about the development of a tracing app.
Mm.
And on this occasion, the attempt to make one in-house, as it were, a sort of government app rather than using, let's say, Google,
yeah,
or Apple or whoever it might be, those attempts seem to have failed. So was there something different that was done there that meant that that wasn't a success?
I think what went wrong there was that the government had to do its own thing. You know, another failing of government can be not to learn lessons from other people, to think that, you know, your way has to be the right way. And I think they didn't look abroad. They didn't look at what the Germans were doing, where they've had some success with an app. And they also, I think, elevated the importance of this app. It was never central at all to tracing. I mean, they're now very keen to say, of course, it was always only the cherry on the icing on the cake. We never said it was going to be all that important, but they did early on. Again, it was about fairly grand announcements. Here's a program that's going to solve the problem. Whereas you don't solve problems like that. You solve them by, you know, taking the hard, intelligent decisions about, you know, what do we have available to us to tackle the issue we're facing? What they had available was a local health setup, albeit one that had been neglected for a few years. But, you know, there was something there that would have worked better. But instead, they wanted the big announcement. They wanted to say, we've got an app. We've set up a new super-duper contact tracing system. You didn't need a new one. You needed to get the old one up and running, because, you know, that was the right one.
And this brings us on to another piece that you've written for the magazine recently, which is another story of outsourcing and another cock-up related to it, because this is about PPE.
And yeah.
you've been writing about the firm, the private firm, that was contracted to manage the stockpile of protective equipment, and that has been for some years, you know, way before this happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is it pronounced Movianto?
Movianto, yeah.
Yeah. What a name.
What a name. I mean, an impressive name for a not very impressive service. You know, again, this is the problem. You have a private company given a critical task, one that might seem, in ordinary times, fairly mundane, storing protective gear, stockpiling it. But of course, when the pandemic hits, it's not mundane anymore. It's absolutely critical. It so happened that the company that the job had been given to, which has these warehouses on Merseyside, was in the middle of some corporate takeover. It was running out of money. It was not paying its bills. It was just a kind of typical sort of corporate financial snarl-up that companies can hit at some times. And it hit one just at the wrong time. And it set about, firstly, not paying its bills. Secondly, trying to engineer a sale to another company. All these things that had absolutely nothing to do with getting PPE to doctors and nurses, for example, on the front line who, you know, were operating without adequate protection. You know, at the same time, they've got their corporate lawyers running around, you know, wondering what deal they can do. So I think, you know, again, perhaps the bigger lesson of this is that for certain critical tasks, you really need a government that's capable of doing it, rather than asking someone else to do it who might, at the time, not quite be up to it.
So those are the elements of the story which are about the kind of big overarching systems that are in place and whether they are in-house, government-run, or whether they are outsourced to private firms.
Yeah.
But there's also been a huge rash of appointments of, you know, high-caliber individuals, we keep being told. You know, we've got this person in to run the task force on this and so on. I'm thinking of people like Dido Harding, who was got in to run, she was got in to run the app, wasn't she?
She was brought in to run the testing and tracing system, including the app. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, you say high caliber, you know, I might use a different description.
Being kind, yeah.
And it's a really important issue because, you know, the principle for a long time, for a century and a half, really has been that public appointments are given to the people who are best able to do the job, and they're recruited on merit through open competition and so on, and there's no cronyism. Back in 1854, William Gladstone got a couple of senior public figures to do a review, Charles Trevelyan and Stafford Northcote, who produced a review on how to change the civil service, so it worked. And they pointed out that people who are given these public positions should have, in their words, sufficient independence, character, ability, and experience to be able to advise, assist, and to some extent influence those who are from time to time set over them. In other words, they should objectively and neutrally advise politicians, and they should be the best people for the job. And that has generally been adhered to, never perfectly, but, you know, that's been the ideal. Whereas the government now seems to have just sort of discarded that principle and decided that we'll get our chums in for really important jobs. So when you look at the three most important appointments on COVID, they've all gone to essentially Tories or people very well connected with the Tories. So Baroness Harding, as you said, Baroness Dido Harding, has been given the job of running the test and trace system, and she's a Tory peer and married to a Tory MP. Lord Dayton, or Dighton, who's also a Tory peer, has been given the job of getting the PPE fiasco in order. And on vaccines, the sort of third part of the trilogy, that job has gone to Kate Bingham, who is the wife of a Tory minister, Jesse Norman. So all these jobs have gone not really to the best people.
Maybe they've gone to the best Tories available, you know.
Yeah, but it's like, it seems to be, sort of reminds me of a sort of parish council type way of giving people jobs. Well, you know, and they're looking for who to do the various jobs on the village fete or something. You know, oh, Dorothy, you know someone who does flowers. Can you get them in to do the flowers? You know, you just ask the people you know rather than looking for the very best people.
So are there no regulations about this? I mean, there are rules about tendering various kinds of contract, aren't there? You know,
yeah.
I mean, big government contracts have to be put out to tender. You have to be able to... There has to be an open bidding period, and then those bids can be assessed.
Yeah, there is a very sort of sleepy body called the Civil Service Commission, which is supposed to look at top jobs in the civil service. There's a public appointments commissioner. But, you know, they don't really do very much. You know, and the same thing applied with making David Frost the new national security advisor. That previously was a civil service independent job given to an expert in national security. But now it's been given to someone who's no experience in national security, but who is a nakedly political appointment. And indeed, the job has been changed from a civil service job to a political job. He's been made a peer. So serious was it that it got to the point that Theresa May had to pull up Boris Johnson on the appointment and point out that this wasn't in the interests of national security to have this chap come in. You know, they're coming from somebody who spent years refusing to agree to an independent review of the Litvinenko murder in Britain. That's, you know, and who's really not the most committed to national security. That really was saying something.
There's a kind of element of all governments getting tired after so many years in office, where you kind of you run out of people who haven't been ministers yet.
Yeah,
people who are early enough in their careers, enthusiastic enough, competent enough. After a while, after you've sacked enough people, you sort of start to run low without serious influxes of new blood. Is there something similar going on here where they've just sort of forgotten everyone who is not a close contact of theirs?
Boris Johnson's managed it after 6 months. It takes everybody else about 5 years. No, I think that what's really going on here is that Boris Johnson at every level, I mean, particularly at cabinet level, ministerial level, but also at civil service level, which is very disturbing. He's making appointments political rather than based on competence or ability. So when you look at his cabinet, really the big question is, are you a Brexiter? Do you have the faith? Are you one of us? Rather than, are you good at the job I want you to do? You know, we have pieces in the magazine every week on how useless cabinet ministers are these days. Priti Patel, Home Secretary, you know, clearly not up to that job at all, not by a long way. So why is she there? Well, loyalty. She's a believer. Of course, politicians have always, prime ministers have always done that to some extent, and it's a question of degree. But here, I think Boris Johnson's just gone the whole hog. You know, it has quite serious knock-on effects, because if you have any ambition, how do you get on? Well, you have to display that loyalty. And I think you can see alarming signs of that, not just among politicians, but in the civil service. You can see certain very senior civil servants who are positioning themselves as perhaps more pro-Brexit. You can hear briefings now about how the replacement for the permanent secretary of the cabinet office, top civil servant in the country, Mark Sebble, has just been pushed out because he wasn't really loyal enough. And there's a lot of briefings about how his replacement will be a pro-Brexit civil servant. There shouldn't really be such a thing. You know, not in their public life anyway. Of course, they'll privately have views, but publicly, a civil servant shouldn't be pro or anti-Brexit. But, you know, there's clearly an expectation now that there are. And that's quite a threat to the principles, those principles from Northcote and Trevelyan that we talked about. That's really compromising them. And that gets quite dangerous, because you get ministers and government just not getting good advice. They end up getting advice that they want to hear, rather than the truth. So if, for example, you were a civil servant who wanted to get on now, you might be very reluctant to give a minister the unvarnished truth.
Richard Brooks there with a bit more of the unvarnished truth and a comforting return to form for both iReaders and Page 94 listeners, i.e. things not working very well. Now, shipping is one of the industries that many people don't give a second thought to, but which nonetheless provides the vast majority of the goods that we consume every single day. That industry has been disrupted very badly by the coronavirus crisis, and one of the biggest impacts has been on the crews who have been running enormous cargo ships around the world. Many of them have been left stranded offshore by their employers. Many of them are uncertain about how, when they're going to get home, and there seems to be no end in sight for quite a few of these workers. Private Eye has been covering this story, and I spoke to Heather Mills and Sarah Shannon, both of whom have been covering different aspects of it. The story might not have been written in the first place if Heather hadn't happened to live quite near the coast, as she explains here.
I was interested because I could actually see some of the boats anchored offshore in the channel, and became interested because the local paper was complaining about the noise and potentially the pollution from them. And I suddenly thought about what about the poor people stuck on them, because we hadn't really heard much about them ever since, stories of the fee-paying passengers catching coronavirus on the boats. But few people talked about all the crews and those who are now stuck on all these boats, which largely have almost become prison hulks for them. They can't get off. So I started to make some inquiries and was staggered to find there's about 150,000 people stuck on cargo boats, container boats, cruise ships, tankers, you know, all of those all over the world.
And I think you said in your story that even in UK waters alone, there are 7,000 crew.
Yeah. And I think there are in offshore waters, there are about 2,000 UK citizens stuck around the world.
So these people have been on these, whatever it might be, container ships, or sometimes, so I guess some cruise ships are still, you know, just parked in various bits of water around the place. What are the conditions like for them at the moment? I know they'll be variable, obviously.
I think the most awful thing is their feelings of helplessness and isolation. Contact is pretty bad for some people. There are even suggestions that, you know, kind of like Wi-Fi is turned down. Pay and conditions on some of the cargo and container boats and tankers are not as great as those on cruise ships. Yeah, so quite grim for them. Lots of them can't send money back to their families, which is quite often an issue as well. There have been suicides because they've been so isolated and worried about their families. Can't get home for, you know, families that have caught COVID or are dying for other reasons. So, yeah, potentially quite grim.
And you've been in contact with a charity called Mission to Seafarers.
Yeah, they're a sort of great charity. They do work in lots of countries, mainly providing sort of counselling, but also practical help, because, you know, quite often welfare issues are lost in seaports all around the world.
And this is obviously is work which is quite lonely and isolated even at the best of times, but these circumstances are so unusual. And one of the things you mentioned is that some of these people have now been at sea for more than a year, which is quite unusual even for a long contract.
Yeah, I think contracts, Sarah might correct me, but there are around 9 months, a lot of them. So a lot of people are out of contract and not being paid. Some have been forced to sign new contracts, which mean they'll be away from their families even longer.
Yeah. And so, Sarah, you've been writing about this story in the latest issue of the mag as well. And you've been writing a bit about the attempts to get a lot of these seafarers home and who's in charge of it, in a sense.
Well, the shipping owners themselves should be in charge of it. But sadly, not all shipping owners are behaving as well as they should and not being as helpful to their crew members as they should. Sometimes it's not their fault. Sometimes it's because of international travel restrictions or quarantine restrictions in the areas that the ship's docked in where the crew are supposed to change. But on other occasions, there's Nautilus, the Seafarers Trade Union, are very involved in trying to get shipping owners and governments to play their part so that, as Heather says, the crew can change and they're not stuck on what effectively become prisons for them. I mean, imagine being told that your shift's not going to end when you thought it was going to end, but this isn't a few day shift or a few weeks or a few months. As Heather says, it could be up to a year. I mean, it's really, you know, cruel beyond belief.
It's extraordinary. And interestingly, there is a British or a kind of London angle to this, because the International Maritime Organization, you've written, is is based in London. It's a UN body, obviously, but it's set in the UK, and they are trying to campaign about it.
Yes, they held a Day of the Seafarer recently. They're lobbying governments to make seafarers into key workers so that they can get those flights home, and just encouraging shipping owners and governments to facilitate crew changes. But, you know, not all governments are playing ball. And my recent article mentioned Panama, which is a big player in the shipping world. It's the world's largest shipping registry. It's an open register. It's what people would refer to as a flag of convenience, which is a slightly disparaging term. But Panama's been one of those flags of convenience since Prohibition days, when American ship owners wanted to serve their passengers alcohol and they couldn't. So they signed up with the Panamanian register, and hence this huge industry for Panama was born.
Liberia's another big one, isn't it?
Yes, Liberia and the Marshall Islands. I think between those three, they make up something like 40% of the world's shipping is registered with those three quite small nations.
So just to be clear, even if your ship was built, let's say it was built in the UK, it's crewed by the staff who are from the Philippines or from Russia or Ukraine or wherever, and it's travelling to completely different nations with crew, with cargo from other places, it's still going to be registered most likely with one of these three nations.
Yes, and there's a good reason for that. These days it's usually to do with rules about how cheap the labour you employ on board, or environmental regulations or tax rules seem more favourable in those countries than if you're, you know, a Danish shipping owner registering in Denmark or a British shipping owner registering in Britain.
And they're less likely to be enforced as well, aren't they, when the regulations are broken?
Yes, exactly. So lots of countries have signed up to something called the Paris Memorandum of Understanding, I think that's the right term, where they exercise port state control. So they're allowed to bring in ships and check that they're adhering to international shipping regulations and international labour laws. But the flags of convenience aren't quite so hot on that.
Yeah, it's kind of the original offshore industry, if you like.
Yes, yeah. It is. You're right.
I mean, this is an extraordinary element of the story that you've written recently, Sarah, is that the International Maritime Organization has just congratulated Panama.
They've congratulated them on making their seafarers key workers. But shortly after that, and Panama was very happy and sort of trumpeting this praise from the International Maritime Organization. But shortly after that, it issued an advisory note to its shipping owners saying that they were, in fact, allowed to extend their seafarers' contracts by a further 3 months. And according to the trade union, that could make a single contract up to 17 months long. So far from, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel of getting to go home, see family, as Heather said, you know, potentially see family who might have suffered from COVID themselves, they're actually still going to be stuck on board their ships. And Nautilus has called for Panama to be blacklisted as a result of this. But it's interesting to see whether the International Maritime Organization will choose to pick up on this and target Panama directly, because Panama also happens to be the largest contributor to the IMO's budget, as it's the largest shipping registry in the world.
The story seems to involve a lot of people who kind of fall through the cracks. I mean, the overwhelming majority of them are from the Philippines and India, these sailors, who are clearly key workers by any definition, because they deliver 90% of the world's products where they need to be. And yet they're somehow really out of sight, out of mind, literally.
And not well paid either, really, given that, you know, they're working, you know, 7 days a week quite often.
Yeah, and not in good conditions either. It's not a fun working environment, to put it mildly.
No, it's not like the good old days when my dad and my brother, in fact, were both merchant sailors. And, you know, they had their time ashore, living it up in whatever port town they were in. But nowadays, I think it's pretty much dock, and if you're lucky, you might step ashore, but sometimes not even that. It's such an efficient mechanized operation now. It just, you know, the seafarers barely see the land before they're off again.
And sometimes they can be stuck, can't they, on oil tankers while oil tankers anchor off waiting for the price of oil to change. And, you know, the owners clearly feel it's, you know, it's cheaper to pay your crew to sit out at sea for a bit and make, you know, the extra pence per gallon or whatever price they sell oil at.
There has been some progress in terms of getting people home. For example, the British government has designated workers on cargo ships as key workers, which has helped in a lot of regards. Are there other obstacles still remaining in terms of getting people back to where they need to be?
I think you've still got to overcome sort of travel restriction, you know, in various jurisdictions. You know, the country where the seafarers come from, there's got to be flights, there's got to be provision. And then you've also got the difficulties of countries just not wanting to offload lots of ships, you know, on their shores.
Yes, as Heather says, there's so many other issues. And where has their ship ended up? Has it ended up in a COVID hotspot? Are they not then welcome back into their home country for that reason? And Nautilus, the trade union's been pointing out that some crew being put into quarantine, but they're not being paid for that period of quarantine, even though it's clearly their work, their employment that's meant they've had to go into it. But then they have 2 weeks unpaid at the other end of it. So another bit of unfairness towards them.
Sarah Shannon there, thanks to her and Heather Mills. And the story doubtless, as you can hear, has a lot further to run. And finally, what happens if you combine two billionaires, an enormously valuable company, several children and grandchildren, a luxury hotel, and some reasonably inexpensive bugging equipment? Francis Ween is here to tell us all about the story of the Barclay brothers. Here he is.
It's such a classic story. I mean, it's got elements of everything from that thing Succession to King Lear, practically. It's, you know, an elderly ruler who is falling out with the rest of his family because they are spying on him and trying to get their inheritance sorted out, and he mistrusts what they're up to, quite rightly, as it turns out. There's a lot of it about. I mean, it's extraordinary. Just in the last week, it's happened exactly the same thing as happened with the Hinduja family of blessed memory, the ones who got into scrapes with Peter Mandelson years ago. The elder Hinduja brother, aided by his daughter, is suing three other Hinduja brothers over the divvying up of the family spoils if and when he dies. The only difference is he is, I think, 84, whereas Sir Frederick Barclay, who is the claimant, well, one of the claimant Barclays in Barclay v. Barclay v. Barclay v. Barclay v. Barclay, Sir Fred is 85 rather than 84, but apart from that, it is weirdly similar, because Sir Fred, on his side, has his daughter, Amanda, and he and Amanda, of an evening, used to like sitting in the conservatory of the Ritz Hotel, which they owned, the Barclays in general owned, discussing business affairs. And
okay, so just for the benefit of any listeners who don't have the Barclay family tree in front of them,
yeah,
I think it's important to get it pretty clearly nailed down. So,
well, the two big Barclays, Sir David and Sir Fred, who founded the whole thing,
yeah,
who are identical twins, just to confuse matters further.
Okay.
And who until now did everything together. I mean, they were knighted together. Almost the only photo in existence of them is the one the day they went to the palace to get knighted, and they were wearing identical ties, identical everything.
They lived together.
They lived together on this sort of weird Bond villain-like fortress on the Channel Island of Brecu. So they were all these decades. They've been in business together. They've lived together. They've been inseparable. And suddenly now that they're in their slightly twilighty years, the family is falling out big time.
So Frederick Barclay has a daughter, Amanda, and David has sons including, well, I mean, lots of sons and some grandsons involved in this case.
Well, Sir David's sons, the defendants, Sir Frederick and his daughter, are suing Sir David's sons, Aidan, Howard, and Alistair. And Aidan is the chairman of the Telegraph Media Group, which is what gives it an extra resonance. And Howard is the director of the Telegraph Media Group. So these are press barons, apart from everything, apart from owning, having owned the Ritz and having owning Yodel delivery services and Littlewood's catalogues and all sorts of other stuff. And so there's Aidan, Howard, and Alistair. Alistair is the junior of the one. He's the son by Sir David's later wife, known in certain circles of the family as the Mexican firecracker. I don't know why. But anyway, so he's much younger. He's in his 30s, Alistair. And he's the kind of, until now, had been lesser known. I mean, he was the kind of Zeppo or Gummo of the family. And then there's a fourth one who's being sued, who's the next generation down, Andrew Barclay. He really is the Gummo, I think.
Okay.
No one's ever heard of him. And he is the son of Aidan, the chairman of the Telegraph. Do keep up.
Okay, so Frederick and Amanda are together suing these four Barclays on the other side, the sons and in one case grandson of Sir David Barclay.
Yes, so Sir Fred is essentially suing his three nephews and one great-nephew.
Okay, and tell us what the lawsuit is about.
Well, it's because they had been worrying, the nephews, that Sir Fred, because the business is slightly winding down and being broken up in the sense that it's passing to the next generation. So over the last year or so, there's been a lot of the Barclay cousins, the various cousins sort of moving into positions and taking control of the empire, while Sir David and Sir Frederick were less and less involved, in fact, hardly at all. Mm. But the question arose of what was going to happen to it when one or both of the old patriarchs died. The Barclays had decided to sell the Ritz Hotel, and there'd been a falling out over that because Sir Frederick said, it's worth at least £1 billion. I can get you a buyer who'll pay £1 billion for it.
Okay.
And the nephew Barclays said, you leave it to us. But then, they, according to their version, they then did say, well, actually, I suppose if you could find someone willing to pay £1 billion, yeah, all right, you go and have a look. And he then claims he then did come up with not one but two bidders who were willing to pay that much.
Right.
I think one of them was from Saudi Arabia. The other Barclays then decided Sir Fred was up to no good. And so they planted a bug in the Ritz Hotel Conservatory, where he liked to sit and smoke his cigars and chat with his daughter and chat with his lawyers and other business advisors and associates and things. And so they snuck in, the junior of the nephews, Alistair, nipped in and planted a little listening device in the conservatory just by the chair where Fred used to sit. And hundreds and hundreds of hours of conversations were recorded. This started at the beginning of November last year and went right through till late January this year. And all these things were then transcribed by a firm called Quest, which is run by the former commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, bizarrely, Lord Stevens, which is not the sort of thing you expect senior ex-police people to do. There's some argument among lawyers about at what point it might or might have become illegal. But I think if it was involving anything to do with telecommunications, it would then become illegal. But this was old style. Alistair would go in there every few days, remove the listening bug, put in a new one, into the wall socket. It looked like a normal sort of plug or adapter. Take it back, give it to Lord Stevens's firm, and they would then transcribe it like mad. And he would then share these with his two brothers, Aidan and Howard, and with the great-nephew, Andrew. And there's the Barclay defendants are arguing slightly about how involved each of them was. And as Aidan is the most prominent one, he's the chairman of the Telegraph Group, they are doing their best to shield him by saying he was the least involved, but they can't pretend he wasn't involved because there's documentary evidence of him sending messages in a WhatsApp group to the other brothers saying, oh, we've got a really good one here, this tape that we've just read the transcript of. And it only ended when one day, Alistair was caught red-handed on CCTV, changing the listening device in the Ritz Conservatory. And that was the end of that. That was when Fred suddenly realised that all his conversations had been bugged. And he sued his nephews. And it's been winding its way through the High Court ever since. Because to start with, he went to court and got an order, a sort of delivering up type order saying that they should hand over all the transcripts and recordings they'd got so he could see the scale of the damage and what they'd been up to. They resisted this, but were ordered to a judge to do it in February, I think it was. But they still resisted quite a lot of it. And then in May they had a hearing. And on the very eve of the hearing, I mean, I think about 2 a.m. on the day of the hearing, the nephew's lawyer finally capitulated and agreed to hand over most of the stuff, because they'd been pleading privacy, hilariously. The people who had planted the bugging devices. And actually, at that hearing in May, Private Eye and some of the other media organisations, the Press Association and I think the BBC, applied for the release of this actual CCTV recording showing the idiot boy, Alistair, changing the bug and getting caught. And Sir Fred was happy enough with this, but then when we applied for this smoking gun footage, as it was called, the Barclay Nephews Council, Heather Rogers QC, who amusingly quite often appears for Private Eye, but on this occasion she's on the the side of the bugging Barclays. She argued that releasing this video of Alistair in the process of invading someone's privacy would breach his own right to privacy under the Human Rights Act. And he couldn't possibly be released because this was Alistair's right to privacy while sneaking around the Ritz Hotel looking very shifty indeed. I think he did twig he'd been caught, actually, because if you watch the footage, you can see there's a moment where he looks straight at the camera as if to say, oh, God. But there we are, too late now. They're still squabbling away merrily. And the Barclays have just served their defence, finally, the nephews, after all this time, have served their defence. And they've pretty much admitted most things that they're being sued for. They've admitted breach of confidence, misuse of private information, breach of data protection laws. They've agreed that Sir Frederick and Amanda are entitled to damages for all that. But they're not sorry, because they say it was necessary and reasonable to be snooping on him in the Ritz Hotel for 3 months. And they also say they didn't gain any economic advantage from this. I mean, given that the whole point of the snooping was they wanted to know what business plans he was making and what business arrangements he was discussing. Presumably the point was to gain some business advantage in the sense of at least minimising their disadvantage if he did anything that they thought might be detrimental to their business interests. But they're sort of trying to say that these tapes were all useless in that they didn't gain any economic advantage. This remains to be seen if and when the tapes and transcripts are ever published, because at the moment they're not. They're currently at the stage, I mean, it's ages to go till it reaches the court for trial, but at the moment they've just served their defence and they say Alistair Barclay, the 30-year-old nephew, Alistair Barclay instigated and was most involved, so he's being thrown to the walls, whereas they said he'd become very troubled because he wondered what Sir Fred and Amanda were talking about when they were sitting in the Ritz Conservatory. Could it pose a significant risk of harm to the nephew's interests? Only one way to find out. He bought an off-the-shelf recording device and started eavesdropping. He says he consulted Aidan's son, Andrew, before he even planted the device. And then Aidan, the chairman of the Telegraph, and Howard, they're both in their 60s, were only told after he'd started, immediately after he'd started, admittedly. And then immediately it was Howard, the director of the Telegraph Group, who hired Lord Stevens's firm to transcribe them to help out. And he then shared transcripts with Aidan, who joined the WhatsApp group, it was called the Squirrel WhatsApps, and they refer to these things as podcasts in their conversations. They say, "Ah, have you heard the latest podcast yet?" there's one. The only bit of these WhatsApp messages that's accidentally been released so far was one which was sent by Aidan, the chairman of the Telegraph Group, to his younger brother, Alistair, after reading one of Sir Frederick's private chats. And this involved some Russian businessman that Sir Frederick was talking about and planning to do business with. And Aidan writes in WhatsApp, "Good, now I've got something to shoot at and an opportunity." So it's odd if he says he wasn't really much involved, if he was sending messages like that saying, "I'm going to shoot at something." But there we are.
So these are the pretrial hearings.
These are just the early stages. It's going to go. It's going to run for a number of seasons, I think, this series. It's got staying power.
Wonderful.
Especially because there are maybe other Barclays yet to get involved, because the side story to all this is also that Sir Frederick is currently getting divorced. His wife has got Fiona Shackleton, who did Princess Diana's divorce and Paul McCartney's divorce and all the other divorces, the hotshot QC. So she's acting for Lady Barclay. It will be interesting to see when that comes to court. There is a suspicion among some people not a million miles from Sir Frederick that the nephews are watching with interest her divorce proceedings, that perhaps it might occupy so much of Sir Fred's time that he has less energy and time to devote to pursuing his naughty nephews. That's all in the future as well. So they are spending a lot of their time in court, and they are spending vast sums on lawyers. But I suppose everyone must have a hobby for their old age, and some people take up gardening or evening classes. They're suing each other endlessly.
Francis Ween there. Thanks to him and to all my other guests this week, Richard Brooks, Heather Mills and Sarah Shannon. Thanks to you for listening, and if you'd like to get even more of these stories in a much handier paper format, Private Eye is available in shops and, even more importantly, as a subscription now. Just go to private-eye.co.uk and you'll find all the relevant details there. We'll be back again next month with another one of these. Until then, we hope you stay well. Goodbye.